The March for Children takes to the streets to protest President Trump's separation of children from their parents. Former Mayor Alvin Brown gets a big endorsement in his run for Congress and a win for environmentalists over a developer in Julington, Durbin Creek. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross and we're live from Studio 5 this Friday for First Coast Connect. Just ahead, it's a busy week in the news and our weekly media roundtable is here to break it all down for us. You can join the conversation right now at 549-2937. Then later, call it the French Connection. We'll tell you what an iconic American brand, Harley-Davidson, has to do with our own Fort Caroline Memorial. It's an interesting story you won't want to miss. That's later in the hour. But first is Friday and time for our weekly media roundtable as we welcome four all-stars to the studio. David Barreline is here from the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Our own regular contributor, Charles Griggs, here today.
Good morning.
A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics.
Good morning.
And Claire Goforth, who edits Folio Weekly.
Good to be here.
So good to see all of you. Lots to talk about this week. Everything from a big win for environmentalists who were fighting development in an environmentally sensitive area in this city. We'll tell you about that. Former Mayor Alvin Brown gets a big endorsement, a changing of the guard at Jacksonville City Council. There was a Republican debate this week as Adam Putnam and Ron DeSantis duked it out on television as they vie for the Florida governor Republican nomination. So much to talk about, all of that ahead. But first this hour, our big story of the week. Activists both in Jacksonville and St. Augustine will be out in the streets today and tomorrow to protest the separation of immigrant children from their parents at the border and the detainment of kids at spots around the country, including several centers here in Florida. Now, the March for Children is set for 3:30 p.m. today at the ICE office, Immigration and Custom Enforcement office in Jacksonville. There's another march set for the weekend in St. Augustine. Now, the issue of immigration came up last night during a televised debate between Adam Putnam and Ron DeSantis, both of whom are running for the GOP nomination for Florida governor. More about that in a minute, but in the meantime, pressure is growing to release the children to their parents. Some of these kids are being held in detention centers in South Florida, and a judge has ruled they must be reunited with their parents within 30 days. Give us a call with your thoughts about this as we start the roundtable off at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets go to @MelissaInJax and let us know your thoughts on our Facebook page as well. David Barreline, let's begin with you. People will be marching in Jacksonville and St. Augustine to try to keep this issue of children front and center. There's been a lot of news over the last few days, and this white hot issue has sort of taken a back seat. This is an effort, I think, to put it right back front and center and demand that the kids be reunited with their parents.
It's part of a national movement, a national protest. It's taking place in a lot of different cities. There were several hundred arrests that took place when there was a demonstration similar to this in the state, in the nation's capital. So you're right. There's a big pressure on to try and make sure these kids do get reunited with their parents. And also, I think there's still a continuing opposition to the policy in the first place. And let's remember, policies can be changed one way or the other. So I don't think this saga is finished yet.
Right. There's still no coherent plan that we've heard, Charles, for how the children are going to be found, identified, reunited. They've been scattered across the country, including some here in Florida. The Department of Health and Human Services now says it will go in and investigate the conditions at some of these centers. But the kids were scattered to the four winds.
Yeah. Protest is a part of activism. Activism should lead to policy change. But under these circumstances, what we're waiting for are some significant ideas that need to come forth on how to resolve some of these issues. And with the zero tolerance policy that's already in place by the president, this doesn't sit well and it doesn't allow for a lot of opportunities to put forth some real policy change that can solve some of the issues that are going on with the children. We're supposed to be a country of compassion. And while there are people on both sides that believe that they are right, That should not be at the expense of children being separated from their parents. I think that's a general feeling here. Even if you believe that people are crossing the borders illegally or have an issue with that, you still should have a way to remedy that, along with dealing with the separation of the children from their parents.
And it's 549-2937 to join us. AG Gankarski, there was bipartisan outrage about the fate of the kids at the border, some of whom may never be reunited with their parents. At the same time, last night on Fox News, they televised a debate between the two Republican candidates for Florida governor, Congressman Ron DeSantis and Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam. And this issue of immigration came up, but in a different context, one playing more to the issues that are important to the Republican base, less about the kids, more about who was weaker on the issue of amnesty, and also the fact that Agriculture Commissioner Putnam has a lot of ag industry donors who need a steady supply of cheap labor. That was more the narrative on that televised debate last night.
Right. Representative DeSantis, Putnam's opponent, he's been trying to establish a narrative that Putnam is soft on immigration, taking Putnam votes in the House last decade back when the immigration debate was different, taking Putnam positions back when the debate was different and using them against him, calling him Amnesty Adam. A big talking point, the E-Verify system. DeSantis has said that Putnam is insufficiently in favor of that, and that's the cheap labor thing you come back to. I mean, who's going to harvest this stuff if illegal immigrants don't? And that's really the issue here, is like, can DeSantis make this charge stick? Can DeSantis make Amnesty Adams stick? That remains to be seen. But the immigration issue is one that in the Republican primary debate is being played to the most restrictive, most pro-state, anti-migrant position possible. And the person who gets the hardest line will win that one.
Let us know your thoughts about the March for Children and this issue of kids separated from their parents, your thoughts about amnesty, border security, and more here on our Friday roundtable. It's 549-2937. And so at the same time, Claire, women are planning to march on Senator Marco Rubio's Jacksonville office today and present him with letters from local legal experts. I think it's called Lawyer Moms. We've been getting a lot of emails about that as well, demanding some sort of action.
Yeah, for Marco Rubio, this issue is quite difficult. He's the child of immigrants. So, when we're examining what is going on with these immigrant children and the system in general, I think that a lot of the resentment that we're seeing may be some sort of class resentment, where people who have been marginalized and have had worker protections undermined for years and years, you see yourself being increasingly disenfranchised by the government, and you need there to be some common enemy. And perhaps that is what this anger towards the immigrants is like founded on. But the fact of the matter is that our immigration system, we're a destination country. The United States accepts immigrants. A lot of these people who are entering, they may have a legal justification for staying here. And then we're locking them up. We're tearing them from their children. And we don't know how, if, and when we're going to be able to reunite them. And if we can't reunite them, what comes of these children? Do they live in DCF throughout the rest of their childhoods? Are they adopted out? We know the kind of risks that creates in their lives, and all of the suffering that is literally being created by policy decisions, is that's what people today are going to be protesting.
We're also learning that migrant children as young as 3 are being ordered into court alone for their own deportation proceedings. David, 3-year-old kids going into court alone?
It's very Kafkaesque. It's just, the whole thing is really surreal, to have somebody think that that's due process. And it's such a tremendously complicated, complex issue. There's the difference between illegal immigration versus people coming here to seek asylum because of they're trying to flee a political persecution in their home countries. I think that there does need to be absolutely some changes so that there is due process. That seems to be at the root of this idea that if someone comes across the border, they're not entitled to any legal review at all. And that is the root of this zero tolerance policy. And I think that's really what the protests are trying to aim at.
Last Tuesday night, Charles, a federal judge ordered the government to reunite migrant parents with their children, saying that all kids under five must be returned to their parents within 14 days. Children older than that need to be reunited within a month, writing that the practice of separating families, according to U.S. District Judge Dana Sebra, was implemented without any tracking of the kids after their separation. No plans or accommodation to allow for the kids and parents to stay in touch. Once separated, no system or plan to reunite them, which is simply extraordinary. I mean, when you go to the airport, they put a tracking number on your darn suitcase so you don't lose it. There was no thought given to how these parents were going to find their children.
Yeah, it appears that the whole intent of this process was to be, you know, cold, to really sort of deter people from participating in the first place or seeking refuge here in the United States in the first place. But, you know, given here in Florida, we know migrant workers are an important part of our economy. So, you know, there are so many areas that need to be parsed out here. If the government is serious about immigration reform, it is going to have to take this piece by piece and listen to ideas from all sides in order to be comprehensive and real solutions. You can't implement a zero tolerance policy and expect that to deter people from whatever situations that they may be incurring that are worse off than they are in where they're coming from. That's just not going to deter you. They'll take their chances. They'll roll the dice and they'll just, you know, people will find a way, you know, to figure out whatever they need to figure out on this end of the table versus, coming from whatever situation they're dealing with and the hardships that they're dealing with where they come from. So it is, I think that the government really should take a look at the different areas that is that's going to be important to real solutions here.
And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. You can join us at 549-2937. We'll go to your calls in just a moment. Now, also making headlines this week, it was a big changing of the guard at Jacksonville City Council, as President Ana Lopez Broche stepped down after her one-year term and Councilman Aaron Bowman stepped into the leadership role. Now, this happens every year, of course, but there was a little more intrigue than usual this year. The backstory to all of that is the continued speculation that Broche and possibly also Councilman Garrett Dennis are looking to run for mayor themselves next year and try to unseat current Mayor Lenny Curry. Both of these council members have had a very tense relationship with him, I think is the understatement of the year.
Yeah, absolutely.
AG Gankarski, will Broche and Dennis make it a run, or will they decide it's not a winnable race?
I think it'll be one or the other. Ana Broche is having some productive conversations with the kind of people who could fund her. Garrett Dennis is talking like a candidate, but they're friends. They are natural allies. They're not going to run against each other because they're not going to split the vote that way. But last night was all about the changing of the guard, handing off the baton from Broche, who has clashed with the administration on issues ranging from the Kids Hope Alliance to JEA to professional comportment, to Aaron Bowman, who basically is carrying the mayor's agenda. Bowman gave a shout out from the stage to Lenny Curry on the Jacksonville Landing issue. So, you know, now the council is going to be officially behind Curry in his moves to take the landing away from Tony Slane. And meanwhile, Broche was interesting herself. She gave shout outs to Katrina Brown and Reggie Brown, the two indicted and suspended counselors that she put on the Finance Committee. They're no longer on the Finance Committee because they're no longer on council, of course. I asked Broche about it, and she says she thought it was appropriate because, you know, they were council members even if they were suspended. I have a feeling that if Broche gets in this race or Dennis gets in the race, the oppo is going to be sky high against them. It's going to be released bit by bit by the mayor's political machine. If they run for council, they're going to get that same oppo for those opponents. So it's kind of a no-win situation. Somebody has to run against Lenny Curry because Lenny Curry is basically demanding it. He's going on Twitter and talking about obstructionists and things like that, sounding like Mao Zedong with this sort of purging rhetoric. And so, you know, if Ana Broche and or Garrett Dennis want to have any street cred, one needs to step in the race and the other one needs to make sure that, you know, run interference for.
Claire. Yeah, Brochet Stopes in the race. I think the understanding is that the Democrats will get out of her way and quietly support her. But the problem, I think, at this point is the just in dollars and cents. Lenny Curry has a huge war chest for his campaign. I know that some of that money may be parsed out to other candidates that he is trying to push through for city council. But a lot of people are looking at the upcoming mayoral election as sort of a make or break for JEA. Disclosure, my husband's an employee. I think that people in Jacksonville would like to see this be a competitive race. They would like to have an opportunity to cast a vote for a candidate. Some people still very much support Lenny Curry, but, you know, AG says the oppo is going to be sky high on Garrett Dennis and Ana Lopez Brochet, but I think the oppo is going to be even higher on Mayor Curry, and most of it was written by himself through decisions and statements that his administration has made.
Who would get your vote in next year's mayor's race, Lenny Curry or a challenger? Give us a call, 549-2937. Meanwhile, I think as AG pointed out, here's a tweet from the mayor. We have 3 years of winning for Duval with big council support and collaboration. Keep the momentum. Those that obstruct fail. They are political opportunists with no ideas or plan. Local history will forget them. Remain relentless and join me here at Jack's on the Rise.
And then
there's a link to, you know, donate to the Curry campaign, of course, because fundraising is the name of the game.
I thought last night's,
Claire mentioned JEA. I mean, I'm sure if Ana Brochet gets in the race, and I would not be surprised if she decides to do that, that she can say, well, I proudly obstructed the move to sell JEA. And then it would become a case where two candidates, if you do have that race, would be forced, I think, as a good thing, to tell voters ahead of the next four-year term, here's what I will do in my next term or won't do with JEA. So voters know, and whoever does get elected has a mandate one way or the other.
Yeah, I thought last night's ceremony was sort of benign, a lot of stuff being held close to the vest. It was very brief at the request of President Bowman. Not a lot of fanfare in speech from him or Vice President Wilson on purpose, because I think they've realized that they're going to be, sort of in power for the next year, and they can move things the way they want to without a lot of restriction. Right. But at the same time, if former President Brochet decides to run, it'll be interesting because everybody has a record. And it's not like when the last two elections we had for mayor, where people were coming in as newcomers, as former business people and so forth. They have records, JEA will be a large portion of the discussion, along with many other issues that the mayor supported and the former council president supported. And people will be able to make decisions based on those.
All right, let's go to your calls, 549-2937. Who would get your vote in next year's Jacksonville mayor's race? Dave is in Nassau County, so he can't vote in the race, but he's on the line. Hi, Dave. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My comment and question is simply that in the course of this discussion about the various candidates, one of the first things that is mentioned is how much money they have for a campaign. Now, I would think that given that the degree to which money influences politics nowadays, isn't this just illustrative of the fact that we need to have a way of separating money from politics so that people and not moneyed interests are represented in our elections? And I'll take your responses off the air. Thank you.
Sure. Hi. And
I'd like to respond to that.
I'm sure you would. But first, let me point out quickly that a Democratic socialist won in New York, even though her opponent outspent her 10-1. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez will be the nominee for Congress in that district, which is very unlike any district here, of course, in Florida, and is an outlier. But she showed that if you tap into base voters' biggest issues and you work hard, you can beat a well-financed incumbent.
You know, she raised $128,000, had outside help. I mean, we've got people right now in the bout against Lenny Curry that have like $100 on hand, $700 on hand. Those aren't serious candidates. I mean, I understand the pervasive influence of money on politics. But I got to tell you this, if you can't raise money, you cannot win. You're dealing with low information, no information voters out there. And, you know, to act like people are really paying attention and sipping their coffee and just mulling it, no. Most of the people voting, the deciding voters in these elections, respond to stimuli. How do you get stimuli? You buy it.
I would say that during the last election, people will tell you that what won was Mayor Curry's pounding of the pension reform and putting more money into the Jacksonville Journey. Those were two issues he just pounded over the airways, and it was just too much for the Alvin Brown campaign to take up. So the money in this market will make a difference in the mayor's race. It's just we can pretty much predict how voters react in this area.
Alvin had money too, though. That's the thing. And Alvin ran ads that were ineffective. I mean, Alvin's defenses of his record rang hollow. His rhetoric had gotten worn out on people. So it wasn't that Alvin Brown didn't have money. Alvin Brown had, what, $4 million at his disposal? He had money coming in from all over the place. You know, that was a messaging failure. I don't think you have to have the most money to win an election, but I think you have to have enough money that is reasonably competitive. And you have to have a strategy to make sense. And, you know, Alvin's failure strategy.
There is some movement nationally to get the money out of politics by overturning Citizens United through a constitutional amendment, which is really the most likely way that will occur.
Let's go to Linda in Bay Meadows now. Hi, Linda. Good morning.
Good morning. I would like just to say that I am a Democrat, and I would boldly support work for Anna Brochet, because right now it's about who's going to represent me. It's not the title. It's what they're going to do. I don't care for the mayor's rhetoric. He is a mini 45. You know, he's going to tell the citizens, you know, relentless this. I mean, I'm looking for somebody who can be upfront and not just push things forward. So for any other Democrats out there, that's old school. It's who you can work with to get some of your interests, because I don't think the mayor is going to represent me one bit.
And why do you think Anna Brochet, what issues would you see Anna Brochet representing
on? Well, one of the first things is JEA. There was no transparency about that at all. The mayor and his supporters, or his money pit, obfuscated that they had already come to the table with a plan for JEA. They have a plan for the landing. We don't know about it before he filed suit. And I don't think it's good. Now, it might be good business. He was a businessman, they say. But I don't think it's good governance. My taxes that he wants to keep low, he's using my tax dollars to file litigation. Okay? He did not get my permission to do that. He didn't hold any softened, you know, meetings to see what do the citizens of Jacksonville, we want development downtown. And he's giving development and tax breaks or tax subsidies of $18 million to a donor across the river, but he wants to tear down the landing. So what is he going to do? Eminent domain? Because he's going to take a business that's purchased, that they have the land, but it's owned. I want somebody who's not going to represent the 40% of Jacksonville or 50%, whatever that represents them. I'm looking for a mayor who is willing to come to the table and listen to all sides. He has a good pretense that he does that. He goes to people's districts and doesn't invite the council person. He's mean-spirited as far as I'm concerned, and he's not been a very professional person. He's been a good Republican politician, but I don't think he's been a good servant of the people.
All right. Thanks,
so
Linda.
Anybody, I would support Anna any day of the week.
Okay. Thanks, Linda. And for Anna Brochet, if she decides to get in, David Bauerlein, Charles Griggs, she will certainly be trying to build a bipartisan coalition of people like that caller, rather than going for base Republican votes. That would be, I think, her only strategy to unseat Lenny Curry.
Right. I mean, she would basically look to possibly do something like what Audrey Moran did a few years ago when she ran for mayor, which is try and have a coalition that pulls together Republicans, Democrats, independents, try to build off of that. Could it be done? Possibly. I mean, it would be a hard coalition to pull together. And
she'd
all
have to attract
interests.
Republican women, too, who might be moderate and might not be as inclined to give Lenny Curry a second term.
And excuse me, for the Republican base, typically in this market, the issue of importance is still public safety. And you see the mayor out front on that right now to shore up that avenue along public safety lines. And but that may not be the most important issue right now. If people can bring up or keep out front issues like transparency, it may present a valiant challenge for the mayor. But that's a lot of work. That's a lot of messaging that would have to be done. We've got enough time, but decisions would have to be made early enough to get in the game.
Now, if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the biggest stories of the week. 549-2937. As we keep moving ahead with more headlines that caught our eye this week, the name Alvin Brown came up a few minutes ago here with the panel. And guess what? A big name is throwing in behind former Jacksonville Mayor Alvin Brown in his campaign for Congress. Jaguars owner Shad Khan has announced his endorsement of Brown, who is trying to unseat the incumbent Al Lawson for a district in Congress that runs east to west from Jacksonville to Tallahassee. Khan's endorsement of Brown is a shot in the arm for his campaign as he faces somewhat of an uphill battle to unseat Al Lawson, who is the incumbent, has a strong base of support, got police and fire union endorsement here in Jacksonville, but really is more well known in his hometown of Tallahassee. And so how significant is this endorsement of Shad Khan for the former mayor? AG.
Well, I talked to Alvin Brown this week before that endorsement dropped, and I asked him that question, and he downplayed it. He just talked about how he had a lot of support throughout the district, and some supporters were from 2011, some were new. Shad Khan's one of the older supporters. He backed him in 2015 for mayor. What this does for Alvin Brown is it makes him a player in terms of buying ads. It makes him a player in terms of competing in a Tallahassee market on TV. These are significant things. I haven't seen the ground game from Alvin Brown yet that you would expect. He has been campaigning throughout the district. It's a big district, though. You got to have a lot of events. You got to do the Corrine Brown model, which basically is fish fries, entertainment, get people out. I don't know if Alvin Brown has that gear. Corrine Brown kind of carried him in his last two elections. She's not around anymore. So, yeah, I mean, Shad's going to contribute money. There's that fundraiser. There's going to be other fundraising momentum, but it remains to be seen what Alvin can do with it. I haven't seen his operation really step up to the next level yet.
Some people are fairly surprised at the amount of momentum he's gotten with some of the local corporate folks. And then this endorsement from Shad Khan is a big deal because the Jaguars are a big deal here, and to get support from the owner over the incumbent congressman is something that sort of, in a lot of people's eyes, changes the game. There have been some disappointments in the community at the way he has run his campaigning. But I think that this may be something that allows him to get some momentum to change some minds, or at least get people a chance to give him a second look.
Now, Lawson never showed up for Shad Khan. I mean, Shad Khan invited him to Jaguars games, wanted to meet with him. And Paul Hardin, Shad Khan's lawyer, basically said that Lawson was not interested in coming to Jacksonville. So that's that story there.
Yeah, that's a challenge.
All right. And how about the fact, too, Claire, that we've seen this campaign messaging from Alvin Brown that is much more to the left than how he talked when he was mayor of Jacksonville. He's speaking out strongly against the separation of kids from families at the border, sharply criticizing President Trump about that. He's made a number of other campaign statements that are far more in line with the Democratic Party's progressive base than the kind of rhetoric he espoused while he was the mayor of this city. He's really highlighting the fact that Congressman Al Lawson is far more to his right and even clapped at a State of the Union speech that the president gave. He was, the only Democrat seen on TV clapping for Trump. And so he seems to really be playing to Democratic voters' anger and frustration at this administration.
Which is certainly strategic. I mean, you could look at it one of two ways. Either it's just a calculated decision to court voters who are tired of the Trump administration, who may see Al Lawson as too far to the right, or you could see it as an involvement of his positions on things that maybe he has thought about some of the issues and is outraged like other people are. I think it's probably a smart strategy on his part to try to get to the left of Lawson because the district is seen as a solidly Democratic district. It's for the Democrats to win. So it's essentially decided on August 28th this year. I think that as AG has branded it, an East versus West kind of debate with Alvin Brown representing the East and Al Lawson representing the West geographically of that district. I think that is what this race is seen as. A lot of people at Jacksonville don't feel that Al Lawson is really in their court, that he's what he's been referred to disparagingly as the Tallahassee Democrat. There's nothing wrong with being a Tallahassee Democrat.
That's the name of a newspaper, too.
People here, it is, yeah, right. People here kind of feel like there's a disconnect between, you know, what he represents.
David Bauerlein.
Well, I think that's a large part of the dynamic. Absolutely. Here you have Jacksonville, the biggest city within this district, and yet it's represented by somebody who comes from Tallahassee. So there's a little bit of maybe civic pride or whatever in terms of that Alvin Brown has been able to tap into from his contributions. In the case of Shahid Khan, let's not forget that Alvin Brown, when he was mayor, was a big supporter of doing things that Shahid Khan wanted in terms of these big scoreboards, the swimming pools at the stadium. So there's a little bit of, you know, payback there in terms of, yeah, you were there for me when I needed you. I'm there for you as well when you run for Congress.
And how about the fact that Shahid Khan has spread his wealth around in a really bipartisan fashion to candidates for office here in this city? That's been interesting to watch, too.
Well, I think as an owner, as a businessman, I should say, he's very progressive. And he's proven that with the ideas that he's brought to Jacksonville and the way he's played politics as well. I mean, he was able during the whole kneeling protests last year. He was able to navigate that fairly successfully. And in this market where this is a military town and very, it has been very controversial, but he has been able to navigate that and bring more his ideas and philosophy of growth here to Jacksonville. So being smart about who you align yourself with politically, even after he endorsed Alvin Brown for mayor and he lost, still be able to work with the current administration speaks volumes about his ability as a businessman.
Yeah, and I mean, Shahid Khan's gotten really good ROI. I mean, the city bought the scoreboard for a stadium when Alvin was mayor, $45 million in the amphitheater and stadium improvements. You know, God knows what's going to come in terms of the development project, in terms of city contribution. But, you know, Shahid, you know, giving money to candidates, even eye-popping sum like $250,000 to a political committee or whatever, that pales in comparison to the payoff. And it pales in comparison to the influence that Shahid Khan exacts on City Hall, no matter who's elected or not.
Yeah. All right.
And he also had, you know, Alvin Brown also has the endorsement of the AFL-CIO. So, you know, that kind of, you know, evens out with the law enforcement endorsement for Al Lawson.
I don't know about that.
I mean, does law enforcement endorsement really help a Democrat that much running against another Democrat?
Well, it just shows the ability for him to get union support.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when Alvin Brown gets his endorsement from a Tallahassee local anything, it will be his first. I mean, the public safety endorsements are significant. They are coveted, and they lead to back-channel support that, you know, is measured beyond the cops and the fire people just saying, yeah, we back you. It's more than that. It's the kind of support that Lawson can hang his hat on.
I think all unions work that way, though.
All right, let's move on. And we want your calls as we talk about another really big story from the week. Did you hear about this? Environmentalists here in this area have chalked up a big win. It's unusual for this area. A developer is abandoning his plans for a controversial land swap, and it drew loud protests for weeks. Now, this swap idea involved about 400 acres of environmentally sensitive land on Black Hammock Island. And in exchange, there would be a plan to develop a similarly sized tract in the Julington-Durbin Preserve. Instead, the developer now says he's going to sell the Black Hammock land to the state for conservation. Give us a call. Let us know your thoughts about this. This land swap idea is going down after much protest. 2937. Claire Goforth, former mayor and UNF president John Delaney, appeared on this program earlier this month advocating for the land swap in his capacity as a lobbyist with the Fiorentino Group. It's been pointed out that then Mayor Delaney, during his time as mayor and during his time as UNF president, was far more engaged with preserving land than advocating for its development. So there was a lot of discussion on this show about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of his legacies as mayor, and what many believe to be his most lasting legacy. It was not really a good look for John Delaney to have essentially flip-flopped on that issue, although he was basically paid to have that position. He was doing his job. I mean, that's what people do, and they're lobbyists. They lobby for their clients. I would like to point out that there have been two big wins for environmentalists this week, because the Clay County Commission has voted against allowing redevelopment of the Solite property, and they are attempting to take the company to task to get that cleaned up. So not only are we seeing this pristine piece of land down at Julington Durbin being preserved, or maybe getting some remediation for the people of the Russell community down there who have suffered some pretty terrible health effects that could possibly be linked back to that property. So I think that environmentalists this week should just, have it crack up in a cold one and toast to toast
right.
to Mother Earth.
More than 6,000 people signed a petition to save this land, David, and so 1,400 homes that were planned within the Julington Durbin Preserve will now not be built.
Yeah, the fascinating part about that show y'all had on First Coast Connect was there was kind of Delaney was taking this as an either or, either we allow the development to go forward on Julington Creek, or it's going to happen on Blackhammock Island. And the St. John's Riverkeeper, as well as the position of the people who opposed it, was saying it's not either or, it's we can do both. And even Delaney towards the end of that was saying, well, if we can do both, yeah, that's great, but where's the money? Now it looks like that's where it's going to end up being, is that they're going to do both. And that seems to be a victory in terms of the people who were objecting to the whole precedent of trading preserved land in order to identify
they saw
and
that
acquire
as a slippery slope. And
exactly.
When it comes to this issue in Florida, Charles, this is a state built on growth and development. It's really one of the three legs of Florida's economic stool, development, tourism, agriculture. We've traditionally thought of those three pillars. And so for people that advocate for conserving environmentally sensitive lands, it's always an uphill battle in this state. So this is really a big deal for these advocates, I think.
It is a big deal, but it's also an election year, and people vote, and people who live in those communities or near those areas are living there for a reason, because they value the area that that needs to be preserved, and they don't want to see it trampled on. That's the old saying, right? And they have a voice to do so, a voice to respond to developers like this, and they got their voice heard, which is rare in most cases, sometimes because they're doing it in small pieces, but because enough people heard about it in enough time, they were able to get their voices heard.
And here's a statement that's just been emailed to the show from Mark Middlebrook, executive director of the Timaquan Parks Foundation. He says the Timaquan Parks Foundation has said from the beginning that both Julington Durbin Preserve and the Blackhammock Island Tract were critically important to the city's environmental health. I want to thank Mr. Dodson, that's the developer, for his willingness to listen and thoughtfully consider our concerns about Julington Durbin. Going forward, acquiring the Blackhammock Island Tract will present challenges. We will do whatever we can to assist in that acquisition. Interesting. So so they're coming in as a player as well.
Need money.
That's a big win for the developer, isn't it? Now he gets to unload that 400 acres that was probably hard to sell to the state. And I mean,
The state's only going to pay him fair market value. So,
but they're raising money for anything above and beyond.
All right. And finally, this hour, we're going to forego our Only in Florida this Friday and instead take a few minutes to remember our fallen colleagues who were shot and killed yesterday at the Capital Gazette newspaper in Annapolis, Maryland. Our thoughts are with the staff and the friends and families of those who were slain. Their names were John McNamara, Wendy Winters, Rebecca Smith, Rob Hyacin, and Gerald Fishman. Rob Hyacin was the brother of Florida's own renowned columnist and author, Carl Hyacin. So it appeared journalism and writing ran in that family. And I think this news has hit all of us really hard to see that those hardworking journalists were killed this way as police investigate it. We just wanted to take a moment to just mention, and I say this on behalf of all four of you that are here with me right now, how hard journalists work and how it can sometimes be a dangerous profession, a very stressful profession, not a well-paid profession, and one that is constantly denigrated, even by the President of the United States, who has called us the enemy of the people. We are patriots, we are citizens, and we are engaged in the work of public service. And so I would ask everyone out there listening to just recognize that and to take a minute to read local content, buy a subscription to local newspapers, and just be aware of the fact that we do what we do because we believe in the mission of informing the public. And so did those folks who were killed in Annapolis. So that's my 2 cents on that.
Well said.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Thank you.
I think all of our hearts go out to the families and to the victims there. I've spent some time in Annapolis myself, and it was really painful.
Thanks for being here, Claire, AG, Charles, and David. We appreciate everything you do for this show. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back. Thanks, you guys. Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, November 11th will mark the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. Two citizens of France have found a unique way to say thanks to the doughboys who helped liberate Europe. Christophe de Goulain and Pierre Lauvergeat have embarked on a 5,600-mile cross-country trip on a 1918 Harley-Davidson motorcycle that carried American soldiers across France during the war. Now, even more interesting is that Goulain is a direct descendant of Captain René de Goulain de Laudonnière, the founder of Fort Caroline, the first European settlement in North America, here in Jacksonville. And so they've brought their Harleys and their French savoir-faire to the First Coast. Christophe joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
This is so exciting. So this is a trip from Mobile, Alabama to San Diego on a vintage Harley-Davidson motorcycle with a stop in Jacksonville. How did this come about?
Well, it's a real challenge we wanted to do. The first thing which is important, never forget the past history. And we are very sensible to the fact that in France and Europe, twice in the 20th century, America has been putting back to peace our countries. And we can't forget that we have a common history with America. And the trip is a challenge to say thank you. And also that's very simply, we love America, we love American people.
And we're going to tell you after this quick break about the big visit to the Fort Caroline Memorial on Saturday. Keep listening for that here on First Coast Connect. Back in just a moment.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. A company's cell phone policy can protect your employees and your bottom line. Our distracted driving presentation for the workforce can help.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
Comcast is building a gig speed network providing small businesses across the country with the opportunity to dream gig. Learn more at dreamgig.com. Comcast Business, built for business.
Hey, are you headed to the beach or just looking forward to some summer downtime? I'm Ira Flatow, and this week on Science Friday, we've got some hand-picked science reads for you to take on your summer adventure. Plus, you know that the queen is the most important bee in the hive, and no, we're not talking about Beyonce. But what happens to the hive when their queen suddenly dies? Well, the answer's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Friday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember poet laureate Donald Hall, who died Saturday at the age of 89. Many of his poems were about his wife, the poet Jane Kenyon, and his deep sense of loss when she died. We'll listen back to an excerpt of our interview with Kenyon and Hall, as well as excerpts of later interviews with Hall after her death. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin agree to their first presidential meeting in Helsinki. Violence continues to plague Mexico's upcoming elections. The World Cup might be the least of Germany's problems, and French teenagers get their marching orders. We'll wrap up the world on the Friday News Roundup next time on 1A. Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
And we're continuing our conversation with Christophe de Goulaine. He is finding a unique way to say thanks to the Doughboys who helped liberate Europe during World War One. And Harley Davidson is in the mix. And of course, as you go across country on this 1918 Harley Davidson motorcycle that carried soldiers across France during World War One, we need to point out your connection to Jacksonville. You are a direct descendant of the founder of Fort Caroline, the first European settlement in these United States, a descendant of Captain René de Goulaine de Laudonnière. That's just an amazing connection you have here to Jacksonville, Christophe.
Yes, well, it's fantastic. I just thought that maybe we could have been speaking French in Florida.
That's right. So, we might have been. It didn't work out that way, though.
Yes, but it's also great to be communicating in English. But yes, Fort Caroline, Jacksonville. Also, I have to say that it's a twin sister city with Nantes, which is on the west coast of France, just by the sea. So there's a lot of connection between Nantes and Jacksonville. And on my family point of view, I mean, in the family domain, we are every day to our visitors talking about Jacksonville and René Goulaine de Laudonnière.
You're going to be touring Fort Caroline tomorrow morning with a park ranger to get a look at it. Of course, your ancestor came to America with Jean Ribault to look for potential sites to colonize here in the New World. Now, you're also stopping by the St. Augustine Lighthouse today, and then tonight you're going over to Atomic Harley Davidson to check out those hogs. The Harley Davidson brand, of course, is so iconic. People don't realize that the U.S. Army sent thousands of these motorcycles to Europe to help soldiers fight in World War One. People aren't aware of this history, so this is a way to bring it to light, I guess, right?
Yes, it's very emotional, this motorcycle, because we know it arrived in Europe for helping us getting out of this conflict. And when we sit on the saddle, which has got this original leather, 100 years old, we know that an American soldier sat on this saddle, and this is just incredible, this potential of emotion.
Are you nervous about going cross country in such an old contraption, or are you feeling good about it?
Well, there's two things. We are very worried because it's hot. We are carrying a lot of stuff. We have already had some trouble on the mechanic. But one thing which is sure, we get so much help from Harley Davidson enthusiasts or Harley Davidson dealers. We were welcome in Mobile, in Tallahassee, everyone, and also here now in Jacksonville. So it's tough, but I'm sure we'll get all the help we need to achieve this this challenge.
Andy emails the show. I would like to thank these gentlemen for remembering the Americans who came to France in the First World War. I never knew my grandfather for whom I was named, but he served in France when the war ended, and he was mustard gassed while riding an army motorcycle. He always loved the French, and he would love this tribute to his brave comrades. Thanks for that, Andy. And we're almost out of time, but of course, Harley Davidson has been in the news for another reason lately. They're moving their production offshore in response to tariffs that were first instigated by President Trump. That's sort of become a narrative around Harley Davidson this week in the States as well. Are people in France talking about that at all or not?
Yes, definitely. Everyone is talking about that. But I am not a politician. I'm a Harley Davidson enthusiast. And what is the main thing is friendship between our two countries. The main thing is also, please, 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 we want to have Harley Davidson in Europe. And we're going to say clearly that we don't want more tax on the Harley Davidson. So it's a motorbike of freedom that was during First World War, Second World War, and now still it's a motorcycle of freedom.
It is. And people can come out and see you and this motorcycle tonight at the Adamek Harley Davidson location on Bay Meadows Road, or they can come out to the Fort Caroline Memorial tomorrow morning, starting at 9:30, you'll be visiting there. Your first time there, right?
Second
time. Okay. Yes. But with a direct connection, because you're a direct descendant of one of the founders of the Fort Caroline settlement more than 400 years ago. Such fascinating history. And it's wonderful to have you on the show, Christoph. Thanks so much for joining us. Have fun while you're here.
Thank you.
And good luck on the trip.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Kevin Merchant. Michelle Corum runs the board. Our show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. 1A's up next with their Friday News Roundup. And don't forget to join us at 1 o'clock this afternoon for our new statewide call-in program, The Florida Roundup. We'll take your calls from across the state on the biggest headlines from the week. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. We'll be back on Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.